afternoon, everyone, and welcome. You're listening to Republic Broadcasting at republicbroadcasting.org. Today is Thursday, January 28, 2021. I'm your host, Richard Carey, and this is Beyond the Official Narrative. I'd like to remind everyone, RBN is listener-supported, folks. Please donate whatever is manageable. No donation is too small. Please help ensure RBN continues broadcasting uncensored content well into the future. You can use PayPal on the RBN website donate page. You can call the RBN staff to donate via credit or debit card. You can call at 800-724-2719, extension 3. Or you can mail in your donation, cash, check, money order, to Republic Broadcasting Network, 2251 Double Creek Drive, Suite 302, Round Rock, Texas, 78664. And we greatly appreciate it, folks. We have a chat room at beyondton.chatango.com if anyone would like to contribute. And this being Thursday, I do have my regular Thursday co-host from over in Europe, Wilhelm Felderhoff, with me. Hello, Wilhelm.
Hi, Richard. Good to be back. Good to be here with you again.
Yes, yes, yes. Good to try to get into the new year with all we have ahead of us here to deal with. And I have an interesting guest, Wilhelm, I arranged for you and I to interview with today. I thought you gentlemen would get on well together as well. It's been a while, at least a few months, but I have had him on RBN and other stations in the past. Keith Preston, this gentleman is a managing editor at attackthesystem.com, and he's an analyst with Press TV, author at Black House Publishing, online podcast host, and former instructor of sociology. He's always had a lot of great perspectives, Wilhelm, and I know you have a lot of great insights to interact with him. But without further ado, Keith Preston, hello. Welcome, Keith.
Hello, Richard. It's good to be back on the program.
Yes, yes. It was the end of September, the last time we spoke, and certainly a lot's been going on and developing since then. What are your thoughts?
Oh, well, where to begin? So many things have happened. I think that, of course, the big thing that's happened has been the Trump leaving office and everything that's associated with that. And right now, I think the most interesting thing that's going on and most concerning thing that's going on in domestic U.S. politics is this apparent effort that's being developed to bring the war on terrorism to the domestic United States. It seems as though the incident at the Capitol on January the 6th is being used as a pretext for launching a domestic version of the war on terrorism in a way that's apparently intended to eliminate dissent all across the spectrum. That seems to be what the focus is. When Joe Biden talks about his desire for national unity and all of these kinds of things, that should concern us, because what that really means is that he wants to eliminate dissent. He wants to eliminate opposition. When the events of last year were going on, the election, as well as the riots and things like that that were going on over the summer, I saw all of this coming. When I was looking at what was going on with the Biden campaign and with the Trump administration and quite a few other things, it seemed to me what was happening was pretty clear. And this, I'm going to go into a brief narrative here that I really think creates a good explanation of what the big picture is.
Okay.
Back in 2015, when Donald Trump essentially barnstormed the Republican Party, you know, he was someone that was in a position in terms of wealth and status and all these other issues where he was able to essentially buy his way into the Republican Party. It wasn't dissimilar from what Ross Perot did in 1992. And Donald Trump was able to take the Republican Party by surprise, and he was saying a lot of things that resonated with a lot of people, and that pushed him to the forefront in the Republican Party, I think to the surprise of everyone, probably including Trump himself. The Republican leadership, the neoconservatives, for listeners who don't know who the neoconservatives are, I would suggest reading a couple of books that I am a contributor to. One of them is called The Great Purge, and the other one is called A Vanishing Tradition. And I can talk about that later if you prefer. But the neoconservatives have been the leadership of the Republican Party for decades. And what the neocons are essentially former radical leftists, former Trotskyites and social Democrats that moved rightward for a variety of reasons, one of which was to use foreign policy for the purpose of advancing the interest of Israel, and also to promote this wider idea of a global Americanized hegemony, a kind of liberal imperialist empire. These people have been the intellectual leadership of the Republican Party for decades. Trump was able to step into the Republican Party and to a large degree push these people to the side. So what they had to do was regroup. And what they did was they developed a multi-front strategy. The neocons developed a multi-front strategy where on one hand, they were going to try to co-opt Trumpism. And that's why you saw Fox News all of a sudden getting behind Trump. And they were going to try to embed themselves in Trumpism, which they did somewhat successfully. You had John Bolton in the Trump administration. You had Elliot Abrams in the Trump administration. You had some of their front guys like Mike Pompeo in the Trump administration. But then they also started working to recolonize the Democratic Party. The Democrats, the neoconservatives used to be Democrats, and that's a long story as well. But they essentially started going over to the Democratic Party and recolonizing the Democratic Party. And you saw a lot of these people doing this. This Lincoln Project was part of that. Guys like Bill Kristol, George Will, some well-known commentators, they're all part of the neocon milieu. Right? They started going into the Democratic Party, and they started colonizing the Democratic Party. And what they did, interestingly, was very similar to something Joseph Stalin did in the 1930s, and that was they created a kind of popular front under the banner of so-called anti-fascism. Now, they didn't call it that. They didn't call it a popular front, and except you didn't really they weren't really calling it fascism, except in rare cases or in somewhat hyperbolic tones, at least in the mainstream. But what they did was they created a type of popular front that included everything from people ostensibly on the right, like these never-Trumpers and neocons, and the centrist Democrats, these neoliberals, these Nancy Pelosi, Joe Biden types, and the progressive Democrats, these AOC types, and the people further to the left, right? Like people that are to the left of the Democratic Party. They created this kind of popular front, this kind of, I always called it the neocon Antifa axis. Right. And their goal was to defeat Trump, which they did. And I always thought that if Trump was defeated electorally, the next step would be to try to purge the Trumpists from the government, from the Republican Party and so forth, and initiate a general crackdown on dissent generally from all across the spectrum. One thing that was very interesting about the riots last summer was the way in which the power elite in the United States acquiesced. What they did was they largely allowed the riots to take place, you know, with very little repression. I mean, yes, there were local police departments that would attack protesters with tear gas and batons, and you would see the incident, like the confrontation between DHS and protesters in Portland and things like that. But it was nothing like what real repression would look like. And interestingly, Trump actually wanted to send out the army to suppress the riots at one point. And he was basically overruled by Mark Esper, the Secretary of Defense. Now, that says a lot because that says who the real power in the United States is. Right? The supposed head of state, Donald Trump, wants to send out the army to suppress what he believes is an insurrection, right? Which is not unusual in American politics. President George H.W. Bush did that in 1992 in response to the L.A. riots. President Eisenhower did that to enforce court orders for schools desegregation in the South. So this is not unusual. But when Trump wanted to do that, he was overruled by a guy who supposedly works for him, the Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper. Now, Mark Esper was the point man in the Trump administration of Raytheon, which is the one of the big military contracting companies. I mean, Raytheon is an essential component of the military-industrial complex that rules the United States. Right, so what happened was Trump wanted to send out troops to suppress the riots. Mark Esper and his overlords at the military-industrial complex said, no, you can't do that. Now, the question is why? Right, and it's obvious that the elites, and of course, the protesters and rioters got the wink and the nod from a full cross-section of elites, from the media, from celebrities, from the Democratic Party, from corporations. A huge number of corporations tried to co-opt the unrest and commercialize it. And it's also clear that they were trying to weaponize this against Trump to make Trump look weak and like he couldn't keep order and those things like that, hoping it would have the same effect that the riots of 1968 had on the Democratic Party, which the Democratic Party lost their bid for re-election in 1968, in part because they were viewed as weak on law and order and crime and rioting and things like that. All right, now, Trump, I think, realized this, and that's why he was trying to play the Nixon card. He was trying to present himself as the candidate of law and order and that kind of stuff, and it didn't work, but that's, I think, was the dynamic that was going on there. So I think this you know, neocon-led popular front against Trumpism, you know, the neocon Antifa axis, I think was trying to first weaponize the riots against Trump, right, get Trump out of office, and then use the riots as a pretext for a future crackdown on political dissent once the Democrats assume power. Now, what happened on January 6th gave the Democrats the perfect pretense with which to wage a domestic war on terrorism, because here you have the spectacle of people attacking the Capitol, and if you have a few people with guns or a few people with handcuffs or whatever, and this, you know, they're trying to claim that, well, there's an Al-Qaeda like insurgency going on in the United States, and we need to wage a war on terrorism against this domestic insurgency now. I mean, you see guys like John Brennan, former head of the CIA, claiming this, that we have an Al-Qaeda-like insurgency going on in the United States. So I think that's where things stand now. I think that the system is gearing up for domestic wave of repression, bringing the terror war to domestic politics.
Oh, well, that's a very, very in-depth analysis. Wilhelm, did you have anything to respond to that, or to comment in response to that, or ask for elaboration on?
Yeah, well, I'm very thankful that Keith is mentioning the elephant in the room, which is Israel, which is a Zionist, satanic world agenda, which is going on. You see the same in Europe actually happening now. In Holland, we had massive riots the past week, still going on. Very interesting dynamics. Now in France, it's the same. And it's very similar to what's happening in the United States. And what's more important, that most in the United States, police and has militarized and are trained by Israel, Israeli mechanisms in the police force, in the... And say you see the same rising here in Holland, what they're using for riots, control, crowd control. You see there is clearly an Israeli aspect, element in it. And here, like in the United States, both parties are controlled by Zionist-controlled entity overlords. You know, so it's the same what you see. Also, anti-Semitic laws are being more strict, even... Because in Europe it's more strict than in the United States already, but now Zionism, to talk about Zionism is now akin to talk about, it's anti-Semitic. If you have any criticism on Israel or the Zionist agendas, you are an anti-Semite, which is ridiculous. So it's very good for the past decades already to look at Israel, because Israel is frankly, a microcosmic perception of the world, this new world order agenda with the COVID as a scapegoat, which is used for this rollout, this totalitarian rollout, is to transfer the whole world into a Gaza strip. Actually, that's my view, and I think the whole political arena is facilitating this. They are controlled, both sides are controlled. You have this ridiculous Zionist controlled opposition in Holland, where they talk about immigration and Muslims, all talk about the political right things, but they don't talk about Israel. So it's interesting to see how this is rising here, and also the dynamics, especially in Holland, because that's new in Holland, these riots and protests and military police, also now people calling for the army to be rolled out. Of course, that's part of the agenda. So I'm happy that Keith mentions Israel here, this elephant in the room. If you see what Trump administration did the past 4 years, facilitated Israel on all levels, actually. Israel, and then they say as an argument that Trump didn't start any war. Well, Israel had been bombing Syria for the past 4 years, hundreds of times. Yemen genocide is going on. So this is really facilitating this satanic agenda. And it's interesting to see how this is connected with the United States, because you see sort of the same dynamics evolving here on this continent.
And Will, I might add that another thing that's similar is how the corporations, big tech, these social media companies are in more control of things than the governments, both here and in Europe at this point. It's starting to seem more and more that that's undeniably the case. I don't know. What are your thoughts on these points, Keith?
Well, on the question of big tech, yeah, that's an important issue, because what we have seen in recent years, I'd say over the course of the last 20 years maybe, has been a situation where certainly this has been the case in the United States, where the traditional elites of the United States, and when I say elites, I mean the old-fashioned chamber of commerce, you know, what the Marxists called the bourgeoisie or whatever, that particular sector of the elites has been on the decline. And we started to see the rise of a new elite that is rooted in newer, more high-tech industries. These older elites tended to be rooted in things like agriculture, banking, heavy industry, manufacturing, petroleum. Like in the United States, we have an organization called the National Association of Manufacturers, the Chamber of Commerce types. That's the traditional elite. But now that has largely been I wouldn't say fully superseded, but it's certainly being eclipsed by these newer, more high-tech industries, social media companies, technology companies, generally e-commerce firms. And we all know who they are. It's Google and Facebook and Twitter and Amazon and Microsoft and Apple and all of the many firms like that, as well as all of the entertainment-related and media-related companies, as well as advertising and public relations. And then along with that, we've seen the massive growth of the professional class, the managerial class, the professions that specialize in the dissemination of ideas, human resources management, all of these kinds of things. We have this new kind of ruling class, if you will, that has emerged in recent decades and increasingly consolidated its position and started to eclipse the older traditional elite. And I would argue that foremost among that is these tech oligarchs, these Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, Jack Dorsey. These types of figures tend to be, they are to the early 21st century what figures like Henry Ford and Andrew Carnegie and John D. Rockefeller were to the late 19th century. They are the new plutocratic oligarchs of our time, they represent the technological evolution and so forth that's taking place during our time. And what's particularly interesting is that this new class of oligarchs controls what is now the means of communication. We now see that, instead of the real source of communication being, say, newspapers, like it was at the beginning of the 20th century, now with contemporary technology, it's primarily the internet, cable channels, and things like that. That's the means of communication we have today. And it's these oligarchs that now control the means of information. The Marxists talk a lot about the means of production, but the means of communication, the means of acquiring and disseminating information is just as important and overlaps. Right? And now we have these oligarchs that are in control of the means of communication. And as was said before, they can even impose censorship on heads of state. Even Donald Trump, the president of the United States, can be barred from social media. All right, so it's true that we now have an oligarchy that is capable of imposing censorship just through the exercise of private power. They don't even need government legislation or anything like that, the traditional board of censorship and stuff like that that you see in older societies. Now, just through their control of the means of communication, they can control, they can impose censorship through private power. Now, of course, we have a wider power elite, a wider oligarchy in the United States. I mean, the real power in the United States is the military-industrial complex, the intelligence services, the tech industry, the major manufacturing, the major banks, the nuclear industry, all of that kind of stuff. And then the politicians from the president on down, they're kind of like a managerial class. They're like the managers that you find in a corporation, whereas the real power elite are these other forces that are more like the major shareholders. And that's how the system works. And this extends out globally as well. I mean, with globalization, we now have transnational capitalism, which means that the power of these transnational corporations extends to the end of the earth nowadays. Facebook being Exhibit A, I think it's got something like 3 billion users, something like 40% of the world's population at this point. And we also have this wider global power elite. There was a reference earlier, I think, but to the impact of the lockdowns that have come about as a result of COVID. We really see this global power elite showing itself. The power elite to me on a global level is the ruling classes of all the individual nations, or at least the powerful ones, as well as these global institutions, the World Bank, the IMF, the World Economic Forum, the United Nations, NATO, transnational corporations. There are tons of these, all these NGOs and all that kind of stuff. All of that stuff is a de facto world government. Now, we may not have a formal world government in the sense of one that's recognized, but we have a de facto world government through all these international institutions and then the respective ruling classes of different countries that control and dominate them collectively. I'm glad that Willem pointed out the impact of COVID, because the COVID has given these global power elites a pretext for stepping out and really showing their hand and trying to move forward with the kinds of agendas that they've been talking about for over 100 years, which is things like creating a global super state that they are in control of, and in a way that simply reduces the world's population to the status of serfdom. I mean, we see now we see very mainstream commentators talking about this. For example, there's a guy named Joel Kotkin. Joel Kotkin is a sociologist. He's very mainstream. He's a Democrat, but he's actually written critical of this. He's talking about how we're now moving towards a world that's very much like what you saw under feudalism, where under feudalism, you had the super elites, the aristocracy, the royalty, and all of that, and then the clergy, the clerical oligarchs, and then everybody else is a peasant. And that's the kind of world order that we're once again moving towards. We're moving towards this kind of global oligarchy under the rule of these technocratic and technologically driven elites and transnational corporations and all these other things. And that's having the effect of reducing the world's population to the status of peasants. I mean, we see the disparity in wealth between rich and poor, not only in different countries, but worldwide growing. Something like the top 30 richest people in the United States, I mean, in the world, rather, control more wealth than whole countries do in some instances. We have this global power elite that's emerging and this global super state that's emerging. And then all of these events that have happened in the last year have really accelerated this process.
Willem, is there something you would like to add at this point?
I agree. There's this sort of new emerging elites, but I think I'd like all these political arenas in the West they're all controlled, left and right. This illusionary two-party paradigm is controlled. It's a theater. And I think it's the same for the corporations. The front men like Bill Gates, like Zuckerberg, these are all front men. That's the people we see in the physical. We have this tendency to focus on the physical, on who we see. You know, it was remarkable if you see, for instance, this QAnon movement, how many people believe that Trump was sort of independent and he's really going to do something different. So we have this sort of tendency also to social engineering that we focus on the material thing, on the physical thing, on the visible thing. But I think it's all a controlled theater in a certain way. It's same as these corporations with frontmen, which we see, and then we talk about what Twitter does or what Facebook doesn't do or what it does, and censoring. We focus on that, but this is all controlled by some other entity which we don't see, which is in the occult. There is the alchemical sorcery taking real place by people who have a money machine, money printing machine. I mean, if you know who's that person, who is that entity, then you know who is really controlling this thing. Like I'm sure Rothschild, he said, give me the control over the money and I don't care about who makes the laws or something like that, in that spirit, that quote, which is true. But we focus on the visible part. We focus on these people, these oligarchs who put themselves into the visible realm for us to look at and to talk about, to fight over that. But there's another layer, I think, which is controlling this, and that is this in the occult, in the unseen realm, which is controlling all these visible parts where we focus on.
It's said the most powerful people are names you will never hear, you know, people you will never know of. And yes, we focus on the figureheads that are presented before us. I suppose that's a good point. Keith, would you like to comment on that?
Yeah, a number of things. One thing that was said earlier that I totally agree with is the fact that when we see things like elections going on, all of this stuff is theater. The United States is Exhibit A. The American elections are basically theatrical productions, and they're very similar to professional wrestling, where in professional wrestling, it's a show. You have performers who are playing characters, and you have announcers that are pretending like this is a real sport, doing the play-by-play commentary, and then the goal of the show is to get the audience worked up in favor or for or against this or that babyface character, this or that heel character or whatever. And electoral politics works the same way. You have the parties that are really just theatrical companies, and they're essentially owned by the same people. If you look at, you know, where their money comes from, and you have these politicians who just assume personas that they create for themselves, they're like actors, and then their goal is to incite different groups of quote-unquote fans or voters or constituents or whatever you want to call them against each other, you know, over this or that issue that they don't even take seriously.
Well, gentlemen, I've been trying to skip some of the breaks. We have to at least take the bottom of the hour break right here. But please have you finished that thought and more on these topics when we come back. So just stick around, folks, about 3 minutes. We'll be back.
The peace of the circumstance. Gotta wash away the dust of everyday. Wash it away.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, J.R. Moore here. We have a special promotion going on at Republic Broadcasting. This is a fundraiser for Republic Broadcasting involving the Energy Planner. Mail me a postcard. My address is at my website at thelibertyman.com. We pick a postcard every other Thursday. When your postcard is drawn out, you get to buy an energy planner for $215 instead of $285, $70 discount. $200 goes to Republic Broadcasting. You also get a 10% discount on my mattress pads. So get those postcards in, put your name, your telephone number, your email address on there, And when your postcard is drawn, you get to get an energy cleaner for $215 instead of $285. Mattress pads, 10% off. Help us out at Republic Broadcasting and help yourself to get an energy cleaner at a deep discount. It's a win-win situation for everybody. We hope you can get these postcards in soon. Thank you very much.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Back, folks. Beyond the Official Narrative, Republic Broadcasting, here with my co-host, Wilhelm Velderhoff, and our guest for today, Mr. Keith Preston. I'm sorry I had to cut you off for the break there, Keith. I don't, did you still want to finish the thought you had?
Well, I was just saying that the electoral system we have in the United States, and it seems to be somewhat similar in a lot of other countries, but I think it's particularly bad in the United States. It really is like a professional wrestling match. It's a staged theatrical production where the participants are simply characters, and you have this media system that plays the same role as announcers on the WWE, and that is they pretend like this is a real sport, a real contest, when they're all really working for the same company. And the United States elections are like some of the worst third world elections. One example I like to use is to El Salvador. In El Salvador in the 1980s, they were in the midst of a civil war. And this was a tiny, very poor third world country. And in the middle of the 1980s, they were in the midst of a civil war. They had an election in 1984. They had one party that was a front for the military dictatorship. And their platform, ironically, sounded a lot like the U.S. Republican Party platform. So that was one of their front parties. There was another smaller party that was sort of a populist nationalist party that was very similar to the Trumpists, and although in a different cultural context. And then they also had another group, the Christian Democrats, which were also a front for the oligarchy, which pretended to be the quote-unquote liberal party, and they used a lot of moderately social democratic-sounding rhetoric. And then you also had all these tiny fringe parties that would get 0.5% of the vote. And they had to stage an election with these parties, all of which were either barely allowed to participate or which were all fronts for the military dictatorship. And then the actual opposition parties were not even allowed to participate. And the American electoral system is structured in a similar way. I mean, you saw, for example, on the Democratic side of the fence in the recent primary season prior to this election, you saw how the Democratic Party and then the media, the mass media in the United States, which is the mass media in the United States is overwhelmingly pro-democratic. You saw how they went out of their way to obscure the more maverick or populist or quasi-oppositional candidates, you know, the Tulsi Gabbard and Andrew Yang and Bernie Sanders and people like that. And they really beat the drums for their favorites, which were Biden and Kamala Harris and Pete Buttigieg and all of these neoliberal characters. So it's a very similar system. You know, it's like some, like I said, it's like some of the worst third world elections. And I also totally agree with the point that was made about those who pull the strings behind the scenes are not the people that we necessarily see up front. If we want to know who the real controlling interests in the system are, we've got to look a lot deeper than just the politicians, just the faces that are on television and stuff like that. Even the big CEOs and all that, even the Zuckerbergs and the Bezoses and all these kinds of characters. And we've got to look at these corporations. Who are their major shareholders? These media companies, these tech companies, you know, all of these hedge funds and banks and Wall Street firms and that kind of stuff. You know, there's all these obscure organizations that most people have never even heard of, but which hold controlling interest in a lot of these major corporations. For example, how many Americans have even heard of the Vanguard Group, which was a major investment house, all right? And then that's split up into all these other groups, BlackRock Fund Advisors, Dimensional Fund Advisors, T. Rowe Price Associates, Perkins Investment Management, Wellington Management, Heartland Advisors, Northern Trust Investments. You know, these are the organizations and the people who have controlling interest in these organizations. They're the real government. They're the people that are running the political campaigns, funding the political parties. They finance the politicians who are the front for the oligarchy, and this is how the system actually works.
It sounds like, it makes me think of the phrase "Welcome to the machine." You know, it sounds too large and all-encompassing to even try to challenge. What sort of advice do you have for people? I mean, you know, how can people try to in any way build something which is trying to be outside of this in any way? I mean, I know you've spoken on the topic of anarchy, and it's misunderstood by a lot of people, but limited government, I don't know. What would you say is the best way to deal with things, that no matter what country someone's living in at this point in history?
Well, that's a difficult question. But I tell you, the things that don't work are the things that many people do. The idea of voting our way out of this is a big one. A lot of people are still caught up in that. Well, if only we elect this guy, if only we elect this person, everything's going to be better. Also, I think a lot of people get distracted with side issues. We see a lot of that in the United States with this so-called culture war. The red tribe versus the blue tribe and that kind of stuff. That's just how the overlords of the system want it to be. They want all the tribes to fight each other on the ground while they maintain control over the whole thing. As long as the tribes are fighting each other, then they're not fighting those who are running the show. And I think a lot of people, unfortunately, aren't aware of that. But ultimately, the legitimacy of any system depends on the consent of those who are ruled, the implicit consent, at least. Way back in the 1500s, there was a French essayist called Etienne de la Boetie who had an essay called Discourse on Voluntary Servitude. And he argued that the legitimacy of any system of rule can only be maintained with the acquiescence of most of those being ruled. So what has to happen is there has to be an awakening where people start to fail to recognize the legitimacy of this system of rule And when that happens, it will start to collapse through noncompliance. We have seen precedents for that. One example was what happened to the former Soviet Union and its satellites. The Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact countries combined were a massive, massive territory. They were the equivalent of 23 different countries. And it had this overarching state system that was controlled by the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. And what brought all that down wasn't terrorism, wasn't violence, wasn't voting, certainly. What happened was it simply lost legitimacy. Enough people came to see that this was an illegitimate system to the point that it came crashing down. We can argue about whether what it was replaced with was better or favorable or not, but it is an example of a system, a massive system, that came to be perceived as legitimate, illegitimate, subsequently failing. The United States and its satellites and allies are very similar today. Like the former Soviet Union, like the former Yugoslavia, the United States is a kind of multinational, multi-ethnic, multi-religious, multicultural, multi-everything imperium whose ruling class is ostensibly committed to this universalist ideology, this liberal internationalism, globalism, liberal democracy, whatever, but which is really just an imperium, really just an empire. And then, as I mentioned, you have all of these other international institutions and elites in other countries and so forth that are part of this. And that's really, the Soviet Union of the present period. And we could compare it to other past times. We could compare it to the ancient Roman Empire. We could compare it to the kind of hegemony that the Catholic Church had in the Middle Ages. But we have this system of rule and its own ideological framework that it uses to justify itself. And yet we have within it all of these different cracks that we're starting to see. For example, I think a lot of the elites are starting to fear that they're going to lose power, and they're trying to scale back in certain ways. That's why it seemed to me they were trying to outsource a lot of the stuff in the Middle East to some of these client states in the Middle East during the Trump administration, like Saudi Arabia and the UAE and some of these other places, or Turkey. But really what has to happen is a change in the way people think to such a degree that this overarching system no longer has legitimacy. Now, there's also other things which involve achieving as much personal and collective independence as possible. There are ways in which people can essentially de-plug from the system, unplug from the system, if you will, and develop their own alternative infrastructure in such a way that they are not as dependent on the system. You can do that through the formation of intentional communities. Some people are starting to use cryptocurrency and that kind of stuff. There's things like back to the land movements. There's homeschooling. There's barter networks. There's alternative currency. There's all kinds of ways that people can potentially opt out of the system, at least on a limited way, under certain circumstances. And it's often best to do this, in fact, it usually is best to do this under the radar. It's not something you want to broadcast loud and clear. You want to do this somewhat quietly escape the system. But at the same time, in a way that over time builds this kind of consciousness that recognizes the system's illegitimacy.
Wilhelm, do you want to interject on that topic?
Yeah, well, I totally agree with Keith's last, what he said about building communities to disengage from the system, separate from the system and live autonomous. I think that's really the most crucial thing to do. We are in a war. We are in a spiritual war, mental, emotional, physical war. It's still a soft war, but it will transit in a synthetic hot war zone, but I think therefore it's really important to see it like that and to regroup and to shift the focus, especially because most people don't know anything about this stuff, what we're talking about. It's in a certain way we're preaching to the choir with each other in a certain way. Most people, my friends or people I know in Holland, or here in France, they don't read other stuff than television or the newspaper or anything like that, or Netflix. You know, so they don't know about the World Economic Forum. They don't know about history. The past 20, 30 years has been facilitated this by massively dumbing down the education system, social engineering, the whole LGBTQ, transgender stuff, all that stuff. There's no rebellion, healthy rebellion anymore in the system, let alone people who live independently, who know how to do that. And it's not a nice thing, because I see it for myself. I have to go out. I don't speak really good French, but I have to connect here on the countryside. So getting out of the cities is also a big thing, and really connect in real life, in physical real life with people, and start a community, get your own vegetable garden, get protected. We don't have a Second Amendment, but we work our ways around it here. But I think that's the real focus. So I totally agree with that, because it's going to fragment this whole plan. This whole megalomania plan is not going to work in my perception, because it's so in opposition with natural universal law, that it will fragment, and we have to fragment ourselves, focus on that instead of focusing on the physical, the visible things, you know, with the distraction, what we do. People who are aware focus on Twitter, on the elections, or what's happening, instead of going outside, start communities. I think that's really, for now, in this transition, the most important thing. So I totally agree with that. That we have to start live independently and get offline in a certain way, which is difficult, and really connect around in the physical realm and making plans to start a community. I totally agree with that. I think that's sort of solution-based solution. I think that's healthy, strategical thinking.
And as far as how things will not work, as far as alluding to this plan they have, I mean, the economic system is already so manipulated. Keith, do you see it ever crashing out of the manipulator's control? At the very least, as far as goods, commodities, you could see the interdependence that is forced more and more on a global scale. That at some point could reach a breaking point. And this is certainly already starting to test that very structure. So, I mean, I don't know, where do you think things could head in terms of collapse, and what could that mean? Would that be more economic or goods and resources?
Well, it could come from any number of directions, but I think that one point you brought up that I think is really important is the interconnectedness of the supply chain. Because everything is so interconnected now in terms of manufacturing and shipping and distribution and all of these kinds of things, the collapse of an overarching system would have the effect of disrupting supply chains in such a way that a lot of people who were dependent on these supply chains would be out of luck, which gets back to the point we were talking about earlier. That's why it's really important to be prepared for this, to have some kind of plan, some set of ideas, some kind of mechanism or structural framework where in the event of a collapse, in the event of the system falling apart, you can increasingly become self-reliant and not be dependent on these massive supply chains. That's for instance, here in the United States, people, when they get things that they need, whether it's food, clothes, medicine, or you know, luxury items or whatever, the standard is you go to one of these major superstores to get them. You go to Walmart, Target, CVS, you know, Home Depot or whatever. But what's going to happen when the shipping process that supplies all of those places has been disrupted? For instance, let's say the United States were to collapse into a civil war type of situation. Not saying that's going to happen tomorrow, but you know, we're headed more in that direction rather than less in that direction. So let's say there's supply chains are interrupted because there's fighting going on somewhere, which happens all the time in war zones. Right? Then all of a sudden there's no more delivery trucks coming to the local Walmart with the latest you know, supply of milk and what bread. So what are you going to do for these things? And I think that is probably one of the main deficiencies that I see in a lot of oppositional politics, a lot of alternative politics. I follow alternative politics in this country and in other countries quite a bit, and from all across the political and cultural and religious or whatever spectrum. And I do see a lot of people who aren't really aware of how interconnected the supply chain system is and what would happen if that was disrupted through systemic collapse, through economic failure, through civil unrest, through civil war or whatever. So whoever is most prepared for a situation like that in the event of a collapse would be the team that gets the upper hand, so to speak. You know, they would be the team that's the first to get a field goal because they would be the ones that are the most prepared. And I haven't seen a lot of thought given to that among a lot of people, even with people with oppositional politics. It's they tend to be focused more on elections if they're more mainstream, or they fantasize about some kind of insurrection or something like that if they're more extreme, or they're about just fighting with other groups or whatever. But being prepared to wean yourself away from the system, I think, is really the ideal. For instance, there's a group, an organization called the Startup Societies Foundation that talks about this kind of stuff a little bit. And they're not the only ones, but they're just an example. You know, they talk about this idea of actually creating intentional nations, micro nations and new micro states, and, colonizing remote areas, or colonizing ghost towns, and colonizing previously uninhabited areas, and all these different kinds of ideas. And some of the ideas that are floated in those circles may be more viable than others. But I do see that as really the solution, rather than, say, depending on politicians, political parties, and things like that, or thinking, you're going to have an insurrection against a New World Order or whatever. I see a lot of people in opposition politics that have really unrealistic ideas about that. And I think that simply disengagement, building alternatives, while at the same time trying to raise consciousness about some of this kind of stuff as long as we can, I think that really is the best way to go.
Very good. And Wilhelm brought up the Second Amendment in the United States. Many feel that the First and Second Amendment, First and Second Amendments are joined at the hip. And while we have had the most freedom of speech in this country and in its past, what do you think the main objective is behind this much stronger gun grab we're seeing indications of with the coming, with the now present Biden administration?
Well, I think that the power holders in the United States want to eliminate the First and Second Amendment. You have this, we do have this longstanding tradition of freedom of speech, freedom of religion, right to bear arms in the First and Second Amendment. That's in turn rooted in our wider history of, being descended from British people and English common law and these kinds of things. So it's a cultural tradition, but it's one that a lot of elites are trying to eradicate and have steadily been chipping away at over time. One thing that I think is particularly concerning is that for a variety of reasons, the Democratic Party is in a position to be the dominant party for quite some time to come. It's a variety of demographic, cultural, generational, economic, and technological reasons. The Democratic Party is in the position to be the dominant American party. I'm not a fan of the Republican Party. In fact, I don't think I've ever voted for a Republican ever. So I'm not saying, well, vote Republican. I don't want to be misinterpreted in that way. But it does look like the Democratic Party is in the position to be the hegemonic party in American politics, in the same way that, say, the Institutional Revolutionary Party held power in Mexico for something like 70 years straight. And yes, it was a formal democracy, and they had elections, and they had token opposition parties, but really it was a one-party state for seven decades. And Sweden was like that for something like 40 years. I think from the 1930s through the 1940s, the Social Democrats were Sweden, basically, and even though they still had a formal democracy and opposition parties. And the Democrats seem to be moving into that kind of position at present. Now, and I think that they're already working to consolidate their position as a de facto one-party state by doing things like adding more states that would give them full permanent control of the Senate, possibly adding more congressional districts in the future to expand the Democratic representation in the House, There's talk about packing the Supreme Court. You know, all of these different kinds of things that would create a de facto one-party state. And then that would create the means through which things like the First and Second Amendment could be eradicated simply through reinterpreting the Constitution. They wouldn't have to formally say, you know, pass a law saying, okay, no more guns, period. Or they wouldn't have to formally pass a law saying, okay, First Amendment now repealed. What they would do is they would simply rely on political appointees, you know, token judges and things like that, or administrative or executive orders, through which they could chip away at all this and eradicate these traditional rights by decree. So one example might be, okay, the First Amendment says freedom of religion, but then they create so many exceptions that it's essentially null and void. For example, discrimination. Increasingly, they're trying to chip away at religious freedom of religion by declaiming, well, you can't do this, that, or the other thing because it's discrimination. So it conflicts with discrimination law. So First Amendment doesn't apply there. Or they'll try to reinterpret the Second Amendment to say, well, no, this is not an individual right. This is just a right of someone to belong to a state militia, the National Guard, or something like that. Or it doesn't apply to these kinds of weapons. And then it doesn't apply to these kinds of weapons, and on and on and on and on. Or we can regulate it to death. Free speech, the same way. They'll say, but there's a hate speech exemption to the First Amendment. Or there's an exemption for national security. And then they'll, you know, define national security in all kinds of extravagant ways. So I fully expect the state to try to eradicate these traditional rights in the future, you know, using all these different kinds of methods that we already see some evidence of already happening.
Willem, did you have any final comment on any of that?
Well, there's so much to say, so difficult to respond on the different things that have been said tonight on the show. It's an hour, it's already gone. But so that's okay. I think it's important to prepare, and that's an important thing. This agenda is advancing, all this stuff which is connected to it, and the masses are steering it in the direction that they think. It's important to connect with our community. That's the biggest thing.
Yes. Well, thank you so much, gentlemen. And Keith, yes, we have to make sure we keep control of the language. Definitions can make all the difference. Well, it's been a pleasure. I'd love to have you back on soon, Keith. Have a great night. And thank you to the listeners as well. Please support RBN. Stick around for Dr. Patrick Slattery with National Bugle Radio. And we will, again, transcend the construct. Regards.
Hey gang, Patrick Slattery here with an important message that is pertinent to anyone who shops for groceries, eats food, or just has an inquisitive mind like myself. What I'm about to introduce you to is a segment of our food culture that has been kept so low profile to the American public that virtually no one is aware of how dominant it is on our refrigerator and cupboard shelves. What I'm talking about is the kosher certification industry and the new app, Koshertified, that delivers a comprehensive education on all aspects regarding this little-known practice. After reviewing this app, I found that it is useful for practically anyone who purchases food, regardless of their religious faith or identity. Its database of products not kosher certified is a win-win convenience for all food-conscious people. So why not check out thekosherquestion.com or click on the link at nationalbugle.com and see how modifying your grocery shopping with the Koshertified app can make a huge difference for your future.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.